read the two texts that we read last week, and then I'll read one more. From 1 Corinthians, take a good look, friends, at who you were when you got called into this life. I don't see many of the brightest and the best among you, not many influential, not many from high society families. Isn't it obvious that God deliberately chose men and women that the culture overlooks and exploits and abuses, chose those nobodies to expose the hollow pretensions of the somebodies? And then in Isaiah, God's message is this: the heavens are my throne and the earth is my footstool, so what sort of house do you think you could build for me? Can you create a holiday resort for me? No, all that you see comes from me. But there is something that I am looking for. I'm looking for a person who will be a person, simple and plain. I'm looking for one who is reverently responsive to my voice within them. And then finally, from Psalm 100, know this, God is God. God made us, we did not make ourselves. We are the sheep of God's pasture. Men and women that society considers nobodies are not nobodies at all, because we have this intrinsic reality that we are indwelled by the divine, that we are made precious by reason of our existence. Our story tells us that when we were but dirt, clay, the dust of the stars, the divine life was breathed into us, and that's what made us alive. And as long as we are alive, we carry within us the breath of the divine, and you cannot become more precious than that. And so nobodies are not nobodies. And it is enough to be our simple selves, our plain selves. We do not have to accord ourselves to a society rooted in pretension. We can afford ourselves soul quietness and to simply be present to the indwelling divine and to become reverently responsive to that divine voice within, for that is enough. And as we do, we are able to expose the world's silliness. We're able to bring the divine to bear upon the earth. These are what our texts tell us as we continue now on this lesson on humility. It's a word we saw last week that carries a great deal of negative connotation. It has nothing to do with being less than. It has nothing to do with finding yourself in comparison to another, coming out negatively in the comparison. That's not even close to what the word means. It has a great deal of negative connotation associated with it, words like inferiority, subservience, repression. We saw last week from the thesaurus, even mousiness. But it's not that. And neither is it the tendency that some religious people have for self-humiliation, which is to downgrade our own worth or to focus negatively upon ourselves and say, no, no, no. It's also not a harsh focus on our own sinfulness or our own failings. It's not a way that we, by being very hard on ourselves, show God and show others and show ourselves that we're really serious about this spiritual life. No, that's not humility at all. We begin by saying that humility is reality, because reality is that the earth does not spin on the axis of self. It just doesn't. It's not that way. And to think that it does is to live in reality as reality is not. But again and again, our actions tell us that it is how we organize our lives. Again and again, our responses to certain circumstances, our responses to situations tell us that that is how we have framed our own understanding of the world. Someone snubs us and hurts our feelings, and you see that, and you know immediately that I have framed my life as though it revolves around self. I have a flat tire when I'm late to an appointment, and as soon as I see my own interior reaction, I know that I have arranged my world such that it spins around the axis of what is good for me and my and mine. Our reactions tell us how much we live in the illusion that the world does spin around the axis of self. But humility roots us in reality as reality is. It allows us to live life on terms that life is, without the reactionary response that so often drives us. We said it this way: humility is freedom. Freedom from the lust to be served, noticed, validated. Freedom from the compulsion to live up to a certain set of exterior expectations that someone else or a culture or a society has put upon us. Freedom from the drive to live a life other than my own life. Freedom to live my true life and be at peace when that life leads me to being noticed, and be able to be at peace when that life leads me to anonymity. So that's what we talked about last week in brief. I want to continue defining a little bit the word humility, because it does tend to get these negative connotations associated with it, and then I want to begin to make one application of it, and we'll do a series of applications over the course of this lesson. The word humility comes from the Latin root word humus. Hummus, I guess. No, I guess it would be humus. Hummus is what you eat. It means soil. It means earth. It means the stuff that falls from the leaves and decomposes, and we pick that up, and it is an earthiness about it. The connotation of the word, then, to be humble or to have humility is to be connected to the earth. It's to be rooted in the soil. It means not living disconnected from our own earthiness. Now remember, our starting place is that earthiness is precious. What happened in the course of our religion is we moved. We moved from the Middle East and we moved west. And when we did, we went from a Hebrew worldview to a Greek and Roman worldview. When that happened, some significant shifts in our fundamental expectations went along with it. You remember the first chapter of our book. It says that God created this, and it was good. And he created that, and it was good. And he created the other thing, and it was good. He created the dirt, and it was good. And then we took our message, and we moved from this worldview, and we moved up into the Greek worldview, where Plato had had so much influence 300 years or 400 years earlier. And we had a Platonic worldview that said there is no good on this earth. This is a derivative reality. The true reality exists out there in the realm of the ether, out there in the realm of forms. And that's where perfection exists. And we are really living a derivative reality of that fundamental perception. This is a derivative version of that. And so consequently, this world is not good. That world is good. So when we took the Christian message and we brought it into that worldview, we ended up framing things very differently. All of a sudden, this earthiness became bad. This earthiness. And we began to have a tweaked, crazy relationship with sex. And so sex got dirty all of a sudden, whereas before, in the Hebrew worldview, sex was celebrated. Food got crazy. We started having this crazy idea about what fasting ought to do, and sleep got crazy. We had this idea that we should have vigils and that we should suppress the desires of our bodies because bodies are bad, and that came from this Greekification, Hellenizing of our fundamental faith. So when I say earthy, there's a good chance that you could hear that with the negative connotations left over, but I want you to hear it in the Hebrew connotation that earthy is good. It is made of God, made by God, and it is pronounced good in everything that exists in us. We've got this idea from the reading of the New Testament based on this Greek undercurrent that comes into our eyes when we see it. That's when Paul uses the term flesh, he's talking about sin. Flesh and sin are not the same thing. Sin is a separate category. Flesh is just flesh. It's meat. It's bones. It's blood. It's the fluids that make our bodies, and it's the reality that we live in, and it is good. It was given us by God. And to be connected to that, to not be separated from that, is humility. To be rooted in our own creatureliness, rooted in our own earthiness, this is to live humbly. And this has nothing to do with beating ourselves up for not being good people, or for being weak, or for being sinful. That's a separate discussion for another time. Humility is simply being present in the body I was given. So to be connected to the soil, this means that we don't shy away from the functions of our bodies. We don't treat them as lesser. We don't treat them as unimportant. We are not above the functions of our bodies. So we're not above the energy and time that is required to prepare our food, which sometimes we would send to dismiss and not give adequate attention to that. We're not above the time that it takes to create warmth and shelter, the time and focus that it takes to make relationships work, the time and focus that it takes to do the sometimes tedious daily stuff required to make life happen. The sometimes tedious nature of tending to the significant relations in our lives, of our marriages, of our friendships, the people that we work with. It means that we don't put our heads in the clouds religiously. We don't put our heads in the clouds relationally or practically. To be humble is to be rooted in the earth and is to feel your connectedness with people and to feel your interconnectedness with them. To realize that you contribute to others sometimes and sometimes others will contribute to you. To be humble is to have that deep sense of creatureliness that allows you to know the limits. And that is that you did not create yourself. That's what Psalm 100 said. It is to know that you are vulnerable. And it's to recognize that you are dependent. American disdain and scorn for dependence notwithstanding, we come into this life, into these bodies, and we are dependent. We are dependent upon the sun. We are dependent upon the earth. We are dependent upon the society. We are dependent upon the community. We are in a dependent state in our lives. And it is to know your weaknesses and to work with your weaknesses instead of trying to avoid them, to factor them into your daily life and to live peaceably while you're in the process of transcending them. This is to be humble. To be humble is not to be timid. To be humble is not to be a shrinking violet. To be humble, you can be quite outspoken. You can be quite focused on leading others. You can be quite accomplished. But humility is able to do these things while acknowledging one's limits, acknowledging one's frailty, and acknowledging that we are children of this earth, interconnected with the other children on this earth, dependent upon them as they are often dependent upon us. And made of dust, as the scriptures tell us we are, we need to acknowledge that sometimes we are needy. And sometimes we have a radical dependence upon this earth that God has given us and a radical dependence upon the divine source that is behind it. We are sheep. God is shepherd, the text tells us. We did not shepherd our own lives. We are made. We did not make ourselves. And humility recognizes this. Recognize that I am the created. I am not the creator. The limits and parameters that are set on my life were set by another. I woke up inside these parameters, and I find myself in them. I did not create them. And these parameters are not a prison. They're not a punishment. They're simply the reality that we live in. And when we live well within them, there exists a way to be that can be our joy. Humility respects the limits of my bodies, the time that I need to sleep, the time that I need to prepare meals and to make a home to live in, but it also respects the limits of my heart and mind. I often hear people who have sustained a grievous loss who are saying, I should be over this by now. It's been 6 months, it's been a year, it's been some period of time, and I should be over this. What humility does is respects the limitations of my own heart and my own mind because it takes time to grieve our losses. It takes time to recover from stressors that we go through. After a particularly busy time or after a particularly volatile time in our lives, we need to recover, and humility takes that time because it recognizes our limits. When our hearts have been broken, it takes time to heal. It takes time to recover from having faced an intense deadline. And humility recognizes the limits of my body and of my mind and of my heart and honors those limits. Humility recognizes limitations and lives peaceably within them. So that is a little more that I didn't want to extend our time last week to say. So we have defined terms. So that's kind of how I think about what humility is, what humility is not. I want to turn and start making an application of this virtue, one today. When we recapture humility, we recapture lives lived within limits, as I just said. When our world rotates around the axis of self, it creates a temptation that we carry the whole world on the shoulders of self, which means that when we don't acknowledge our limits, when we don't acknowledge the times that we are dependent, the times that we need others, we tend to carry all the responsibility for all of life because life rotates around self. And so I don't know when to let things go and when to take them on. We tend to create within ourselves a sense of obligation that we carry everything. We need to carry all the responsibility for all of life. And so once we have made the decision that life will rotate around the axis of me, once we've made the decision that life rotates around the axis of self, off we go to do just that. To carry all the responsibility, to carry all of reality. We just go out to take care of what needs to be taken care of, to do what needs to be done. And when we do this, something tragic happens to us. To make things work, we have to shrink our worlds. We have to shrink our realities. We can't carry the world as the world is. We can't carry the universe as the universe is. We can't carry reality as reality is. We're just too limited. We are too earthly. We are too creaturely. But lacking humility, we live and act and believe as though all the responsibility is all mine to carry. The obligation is mine, and so we deceive ourselves into believing this, that the capacity is also mine. If I've got the obligation to do that, I must be able to do this. Lack of humility disconnects us from finite limits, and the demands of the universe all get carried upon myself. But we just can't do it. So what we have to do is we have to shrink the universe down to fit into a small enough package that we can carry it. I have to cram all that is and all that can be and all the potentiality of life into a box that will correspond to my energy level, that will correspond to my insight level, that will correspond to my creativity and my imagination. And so I have to reduce reality to fit into something I can do, with the result that now I have to live in that new, reduced reality, a reality that's shrunk down to fit to a role that I can fill. Shrunk down to fit that a job that I can do, a possibility that is shrunk down to fit into a construct that I can imagine in my minds. And so I have to eliminate everything else so that I just have the universe, the reality that I am able to carry. So, consequently, one of the first casualties of lost humility is a lost sense of wonder and awe. Our worlds aren't big enough to be wonderful. Our worlds aren't big enough to strike awe within our hearts. When we shrink the world to fit into a bag that we can carry, we have to limit reality to a right reality that we can imagine. And in the process of doing that, we bleed out all the miraculous that's in life. We strip daily life of all of its surprise and all of its amazement. And there's inside of this little bit of reality that we are able to carry, there's not enough there to evoke marvel or astonishment, because we had to shed all the marvelous parts just so that we could carry it all. When we lack humility, we lose some of life's most precious moments. We lose a world that is bigger than we can imagine. We lose lives that are bigger than we can manage. We lose the sense of marvel, wonder, and amazement that comes with living in reality that is beyond us. And the truth is that this life that we inhabit really is bigger than you and I can imagine. This life that we live in really is filled with magic and with spectacle. It's filled with wonder, and it's filled with curiosities. And for those who are rooted in the earthiness of their creatureliness, the stars and the frogs and the kids and the bulbs that come up in spring each carry their own capacity to inspire awe when it hasn't been reduced or eliminated so that we can carry it. When we lack humility, we tend to lose this gift. We also tend to lose curiosity because I really can't afford to have anything more in my life. I'm managing about as much as I can manage. I'm caring about as much as I can carry. I've had to shrink my reality down to this little tiny sphere, and I really can't be too curious about what is beyond that because it might invite itself in, and I can't carry any more than I'm carrying. That would just put us over the edge, and so one of the casualties of lost humility is also lost curiosity. I talk about a lot about listening to the interior voice. If you've been here for any length of time, you've heard me focus on that. But when we do that well, when we listen for the divine center, when we listen for this deeper reality within us, the indwelling presence, the Holy Spirit, however you want to phrase it, when we do that well, when we listen well, often the result is surprising. But when we are responsible for everything, always, we have to reduce what we allow ourselves to hear. It has to be something that will fit into my carryable world. And this is a recipe for humdrum monotony. Yesterday morning, I was meeting with Matt and Nathan, who are helping lead our high school ministry, and we were talking together about the high schools, high schoolers, and Matt asked me how I'm doing. When people ask me that, I try to give them as full an answer as I can. I try not to answer with a perfunctory response. And so I had to think for a second. And when I finally responded, I was trying to hit on something, and I said, well, I guess I'm feeling unattentive these days. And I didn't necessarily say this to him very well because it wasn't very clearly articulated in my own head until afterwards, but his questions and my attempt to respond kind of helped me yesterday as I was thinking through what's going on in my life. That I had been feeling unattentive meant that my world had been rotating around self for a few weeks. I've been caught up with a whole bunch of writing projects and reading projects and church projects, and we've had sick family members, and we've had some tax troubles, and we've had FAFSA responsibilities, and all that stuff just needs to be done, needs to be taken care of, and I'm going. And to navigate these couple of weeks, I've just kind of put my head down and just kept moving forward, carrying the whole world on my shoulders, reducing my world to the task that is immediately in front of me, a shrunk reality that is just rotating around what I'm doing, and what I have to do. So, with my world rotating around the axis of my doing, I look up 2 weeks later, Matt asks me how I'm doing, and I say, I know, I am feeling unawed. I am feeling wonderless, and I'm feeling uncurious. I'm out of touch with reality that is beyond me. I've been living unhumbly, and as a result, I'm suffering the consequences of a reduced, unawesome world. When we live unhumbly, we lose the gift of watchfulness. We lose the joy of curiosity. We fail to live in touch with something that is beyond us. Each one of these becomes a casualty when we have to carry it all. And I'd be surprised if that doesn't happen to you just like it does happen to me, probably more frequently than we would like. And this shrinking our world to unawesomeness profoundly affects our spiritual lives as well. Because our sense of God is definitely a sense of something that is beyond us, something within us that is bigger than we can pin down or contain. And when we lose touch with reality that is bigger than ourselves, we lose our sense of God. God gets reduced to a routine, or gets reduced to a belief system, or gets reduced to a religious regimen. I have a God, and it's in my mind contained in this tiny little image. It's a guy in a throne and a beard, and it's some such thing, and it's sitting in my head, and that'll do. That's enough. That's all I've got space to carry right now. And I've got a spiritual life, and it has to do with certain religious rituals that I have to attend to, certain actions that I have to do, and I get them, and I do them, and I take care of them, and I punch them off my list, and that's it. That's all I've got room for. So I have to contain my spiritual life in this tiny little package that I can carry because I got a lot to do because I'm carrying the universe. So we take the divine, and we shoehorn it down into a small enough box for us to carry. That's what happens when we lack humility. We have to carry everything. And when the irreducible divine gets reduced to fit in this tiny little bag, we commit what the Bible calls the worst sin, idolatry. The Bible wasn't overly concerned with atheism. We seem to be. But the Bible was concerned about idolatry. Reducing the unreducible. Taking God and reducing God down to a little totem that I can carry in my pocket. Or taking God, the unreducible, and reducing it down to a little thought that I can carry in my head. And it turns out that this kind of reduction of reality, this kind of reduction of God, bores us. So when Matt asked me how I was doing, the thing that I was trying to capture was that I was bored. I was bored because I had not been surprised by God in a while. I had not glimpsed anything beyond my own little world for a while. I had not glimpsed the wild and the unruly reality that is so much bigger than me, because I had lost my rootedness in my creatureliness, and I saw myself as too big. I couldn't see anything beyond me because I thought I was carrying it all. And my thoughts and my plans and my tasks and my troubles had become my reality, and I had lost a sense of the beyond. I had pushed everything into a tiny little sphere that I could carry, and as a result, I was missing something that I often do experience. I was missing a sense of the beyond me-ness of life. I'd become an idolater. And being an idolater, I was bored. I had reduced life to my tasks, my projects, my duties. And those can be precious parts of life until they overshadow the sense that I have of the beyond. When that happens, life gets uninteresting, it gets tedious, and it gets dull. When we lose our sense of our own creatureliness, when we experience life as a reduced version that self can carry, when we don't elevate our vision to reality beyond us, we reduce concept to a teeny tiny concept that we can contain in our heads. And we reduce the spiritual life to simply following a routine. And how lackluster is that? How uninspiring is that? God cannot be thought, the ancients tell us. But God can be experienced. The spiritual life cannot be charted out, but it can be lived. And the fulfilling parts of my life have been the surprising times, the times when I see something that I hadn't predicted, that I hadn't anticipated, because it's outside the realm of my little reality, the times that I realize that I'm not running this show, and because of that, I'm watching in awe who is. Now, one of the reductionist things that we do when we fail to live humbly is just that. We reduce God to a definition. Even if it's a traditional definition, even if it's an orthodox definition, even if it's the definition that you inherited from someone you have great admiration for, God cannot be contained in a definition. The Bible tells us that. Our religion tells us that. The ancients tell us that. The mystics tell us that. But we do it anyway. We reduce God down to this tiny little definition. And worse, we do it poorly. We don't even give God a good definition. We give God a bad one, a silly one, a reduced little tiny God, teeny tiny little definition. And the contemplatives in our tradition, they tell us, they scold us, they say, don't do that. The mystics in our tradition, they insist, you can experience God. You really can experience God, but you cannot define God. You cannot pin God down. But when we have to carry it all, we also have to carry God. And to do that, we have to reduce God to this tiny little definition, this tiny little orthodoxy, this tiny little doctrine that we can carry around in our minds and say, whew, I've got the right definition of God because everybody agrees with me, so that's good enough for me. Now I can go take care of the rest of the universe carrying that I have to do. So moving our gods away from a definition and toward an experience, maybe this is something that'll help. A while ago, I suggested a way to help us reconfigure our instincts. There's one thing we know about what I'm going to say right now, and that is that it's not big enough to contain God. However, it might be better than the way you've been containing God, so we'll try it. And this, I brought this up a few weeks ago. I think it's worth a rehearsal. It's the idea of how human beings make meaning. From the beginning, we have always made meaning by telling stories. Stories are how we talk about the significant things that happen within us. Stories are how we talk about our perceptions of reality. Stories about our how we define strong emotion, and stories how we define strong relationships. Stories, everything that is meaningful and significant to the human being, the best way to talk about it is with a story. And the simplest story we have is a sentence. And a sentence has subject, verb, object. Somebody does or did something to somebody. That's the simplest motion in our narratives. So what we do is we take this, that is the way that we make meaning, the way that we tell our stories, the way that we do. We do it this way, and I imagine there's some other culture on a island somewhere whose grammar is different than that, but for the most part, this is the way that we do grammar. We've got a noun, we've got a verb, we've got an object. And so we do this, and we try to figure out, okay, now we're going to try and talk about God. So where are we going to put God in our storytelling, in our meaning-making? Well, obviously, we're going to make God the subject. We're going to make God the noun. And so as soon as we make a noun, the first thing that we do is we begin to look for adjectives to modify the noun. Now we have to say, what kind of noun do we have there? So as soon as we say God is the noun, God is the subject, we start asking ourselves, what kind of God do we have? Do we have a loving God who forgives us? Or do we have a punitive God who smites us? And we begin to wonder, what kind of God do we have? We try to make meaning by defining what goes on in the subject. And as soon as we do that, we have reduced God to a nice tidy box in which we can carry God. Consequently, this is a God that over time will simply bore us to tears. It doesn't matter how great an adjective you come up with. It doesn't matter how big a noun you come up with. Any God that will be contained in a subject, in a sentence, in a story, will eventually bore you to tears. So, to help us get out of our reduced little world, since we can't contain God in any construct that we can create anyway, I've suggested in the past that we think of God not as the subject, but we think of God as the verb. Because if nothing else, what it can do is that can help shift our watchfulness, shift what we're looking for. If we think of God as the movement, the action word, the motion, perhaps that will help us get out of our unhumble experience. When the movement is happening, then we would say God-ing is happening. It tortures the language a little bit, I know. But when a young woman is grievously wounded by a lover and finds her way into healing and finds her way into forgiveness, we see God-ing happening and our vision is elevated and we are gripped and we are surprised and we are energized by divine motion, by divine movement. When we see a father come home under the pressure of a deadline and nevertheless set aside some time to play Barbies with his daughter for no other reason than to give her a strong, secure sense of being loved, we see God-ing happening, and we can be gripped with thankfulness and gratitude. We can be awakened to an elevated vision. And these kinds of motions are happening every day, everywhere, if we have eyes to see. If we will elevate our vision to watch, because we've maintained our sense of earthboundedness, and we can look with surprise at what is happening around us, then we can allow our God to escape the boundaries, the imprisonment that we have given of ideas and thoughts. We can let God out of the tiny bag that we've had to carry God in because we had to carry it all. It's not enough to assent to the right God doctrine. It's not enough to ascend to the right adjectives about the right noun God. These things don't do much to foster a deep experience within our beings. And in the end, they will just bore us. This reduced experience of God gets tedious over time. And then we're in this reduced, containable, unhumble life with God as subject. Even if it's a marvelous subject, it eventually get boring. So this week, I want to invite you to savor your creatureliness. I want to invite you to live humbly, to build on your limited status, to allow yourself this gift of humility, to embrace the gift that was realized by the ancient prophet that said, it is God who has made us, we have not made ourselves. And then from this position, allow the God that you had to reduce in order to fit into a life that you could be totally responsible for, that you could let this God out of your carryable bag and look for surprises, look for God beyond your imposed limits. And if it helps, think of God as the action word. Think of God as the verb going on around you, a movement, an emotion, and watch for it and see the surprising, the noble, the good, because it will be around you all this week. The question is only, will you have eyes to see it? Will you have ears to hear it? Will you be surprised by it? And if you allow yourself to appreciate, and if you allow yourself to savor, and if you allow yourself to cherish, and if you allow yourself to treasure that which is always around you, you can join me this week, because I need to do this as well. And have your eyes peeled for the glimpse of reality that is too big and too precious and too dear to be contained in the carry-along bag that you've got for carrying everything. So Holy Spirit, I pray that you would help us to connect to our creatureliness so that we may live humbly, and in so doing, may we have restored to us the awe and wonder and the savoring deliciousness of the life that we have been given. Amen.